Hang on. It seems to be working fine.
Really fine. It can't master terrible content.
Terrible content. Yeah, that's true.
Although this music app was a worthwhile experience, I think, Phil. That was
it was interesting. I got to say, yeah.
I'm going to need a clean entry to put to this so we can actually record a podcast.
Okay, so let's do a clean entry.
Yeah, do we have to do like a full fucking corporate voiceover? You're live. No, we're not doing that.
93.5 FM.
Well, the thing is, I've been ragging Bezo about his terrible fucking intro for a while.
He's pretty bloodlard. Listen to that
music,
one last week.
Music. Music soothes the savage beast. Music makes the world go round. Like, fucking hell, bro. And then I'm like,
Everyone deserves music.
Everyone deserves music. Sweet music. Even Michael Franti. Maybe not Michael Franti.
What happened to Michael Franti?
I think he just what like, happened to Ben Harper. I'm sure he's still pulling crowds at Blues Fest.
Probably was due to play. Yeah, I was going to say he's probably due to play Blues Fest fairly soon. But still one of my better concert experiences, actually, that one. Apart from when I got out of the gig and had to drink like half of the water.
Half of war again, but damn, if you'd been there, you could have actually fixed their flooding problems.
The only good thing was when I got on the train or bus or whatever it was and opposite all the people who had also been at the same gig and they saw that I had 4 litres of water in my hand and I just knocked off the first 2 litres without breathing, they were A, a little curious and B, very jealous. So
yes, you water hoarder, basically. You're built for this post-apocalyptic hellscape that we're moving to.
I don't know where their lips have been, man. So,
it's not like you can catch anything from anybody else these days.
No, that's right.
Tripping Balls episode something.
Something. It's getting high. I noticed you're almost at 250.
Speaking of getting high, everyone else. No. We're getting up there. We're in the early 240s now. Bezo's off this week, as you'll probably figured out by this stage.
What have you got planned for 250?
What have we got planned for 242? I mean, fuck.
Desert Island Discs 2, the in beginning.
That's probably going to be before the end of the year, isn't it? That'll be 8 weeks away.
Yeah, 8 weeks. So that's going to be just before Christmas.
Probably just some half-assed idea that we will immediately regret.
Give me a call. I'm good on half-assed ideas.
Didn't you do the last half-assed idea? Was the intros?
Yeah, so we did intros, and then someone tried to burn down the Jacaranda Festival, so I had to skip out.
Yeah, which is...
That's actually what happened.
I actually phoned that one in. I had to get out of that somehow. I didn't realise those purple bastards would burn.
It's a long-range shot, that's for sure.
Oh, it was so difficult finding somebody in Grafton that you could organise to do some petty larceny.
Well, it was literally they had you remember the big, I don't know if you remember the Sydney 2000, which was 20 years ago right now.
I'm hearing that there's a lot of chat about it.
There's a lot of reminiscing and all that sort of stuff. But
Sydney 2000 is very now.
The big dolls that they had in the closing ceremonies, the Jacaranda Festival adopted one, dressed it up in a purple dress, and it became Jacaranda Jill. And this 20-foot-high monstrous doll stood in the middle of Market Square and was a beacon of hope and for all.
Burn it.
And then, of course, on that Friday night, a couple of kids got a bit high underneath it and burned it to the ground. And I got the phone call telling me that was happening, sitting in the office talking to you guys. And I went, I got to go. it's a hard one to explain.
Yeah.
But anyway.
But no, we're the only podcast to have live Jacaranda Wicker Man burnings.
That's right. They're good people on both sides of the podcast, though.
I would hate to see what they do to the fiberglass bull in Rockhampton. Nothing particularly good, apart from stealing its testicles on the rig. This is a music podcast.
I know, it's a music podcast.
Bezo is off this week, getting drunk in a campsite somewhere up the coast, not in undisclosed location, where, of course, we met him last year to do a podcast. This is further up north, so at some stage he'll presumably float back on an inner tube, and he'll be back to do the show. So we'll review the albums that we picked last week then. But we've called a bit of an audible, and we've dug out some what I tend to call unheard classics, albums that everyone else or many people regard as classic albums that we haven't actually ever got around to listening to the first time round. So it's worth going back and considering them again.
We might have heard the singles. In fact, we've both definitely heard the singles and all that sort of stuff, but you kind of never got past that point.
And the two albums we got were, this is almost like a throwback to the last time you were on the podcast a few weeks ago, one of 1988's other biggest albums of the year, Living Colour's debut album Vivid, and as we alluded to earlier, Amy Winehouse's debut album Back to Black.
No, second album. Second album.
Breakthrough album. Yeah. Signature album.
Yes, and the last album too.
Autobiographical album.
Yes.
A bit too fucking autobiographical, to be honest. And that's kind of the challenge with this album, isn't it? Is that you kind of have to put out of your mind how it ended for Amy Winehouse. Otherwise, you can't enjoy this album because it's just so...
No.
So blunt and so autobiographical, and she just owns all her flaws in such a brutal way.
And that's the thing I had to go and check. I remember I got a couple of tracks into this and went, Jesus, did she write this? Or is someone else just sort of imposing that kind of... persona onto her. You know, she's got the voice that matches. But no, she wrote most of this album, and produced by, you know, Uptown Funk You Up's Mr. Mark Ronson, who basically arranged most of this album for her and wrote the title track.
In the arrangements, it's a very traditional kind of sound. You know, I was thinking she's kind of like the Bleakest Timeline Macy Gray, because Macy Gray had a similar kind of album in the early aughts, but hers was more kind of mine and a little bit more sort of contemporary R&B, a bit less sort of throwback. This is a very, very throwback sounding album. It's got that kind of big band kind of Shirley Bassey feel to it.
Well, so much so she actually got a very well known band, a group of this type to be her backing band, basically, while I was reading about it before, and the name escapes me, but
that's almost why the lyrical content, there's such a strong juxtaposition there, because you've got this kind of very almost like time warp genre that's it's very true true to the icons of the 60s and 70s. And you've got her singing songs about her weed connection and heroin and, you know, what alcoholism is actually the roots of your life, and the way that she can't stop fucking around on her boyfriend, and all that sort of stuff.
Ex-boyfriend at the time.
Well, or fucking her ex-boyfriend and thinking about her, the subject of the song, which is the current boyfriend.
Yeah.
Not very cool. Well, the thing is that if you can blank out the postscript, then this is like a smart, sassy, sort of self-deprecating, self-destructive, badass of a woman. She's an amazing woman.
It is. Yeah, look, it's an incredible sound. Like, her voice is... It's an interesting thing to me that she actually leans into this kind of thing, that she has this throwback kind of voice with a bit of edge.
Yeah.
But she's into it. Like, this was the style of music that really obviously inspired her to sing. Like, she's got that sort of stuff. And she really leans into that that whole shtick, probably almost a little bit too much.
Just
the songs, I think. Like, after a while, like, when you get towards the back end of the album, you go, okay, like, the most different song on the album, and it's not Rehab, because it really strips back all the niceties out of this, all that sort of, it's just, and the only difference is, apparently the drums were sort of recorded in one room, with all the other instruments with one mic, so it gives it that kind of, cardboard box sound. But there's kind of almost a hip-hop feel to the beats behind this album. Like, it's not a traditional kind of, and that's a very much a production.
Mark Ronson's subsequent stuff kind of has that feel to it too.
Yeah,
it seems like his production is happiest when it's in a space where he's taking old sounds and putting them in a modern aesthetic, if you like, in terms of the structure of the beats, if not the actual set instrumentation that's around it.
It's a really interesting listen, because every song it's funny, because we always, you always talk about, listening to the lyrics, and I kind of felt like that it was almost the repetition of the sound and that sort of doo-wop kind of feel that made me then go, okay, so it's a familiar sound I'm listening to in here, I'm going to go and listen to what she said, and then you go, oh my God, you can see why this had such a big impact when it came out, because this was the precursor to your Adele's and your...
Well, I was thinking about Adele, because Adele was kind of a much more, a less self-destructive, less substance abusive.
Hers is more introspective. Yeah, like much, hers is more sort
more,
of a,
much more.
Yeah, like and it's nicer music too. Like it's. I mean, there is some.
There are no songs about heroin on Adele.
Not
21.
That we know of, but. But this is the album that basically let that, this is the album that made a record producer go, hey, you know that Adele woman, she's got those songs that we could probably, they might do all right.
Yeah.
And I mean, yeah, she's, I mean, it's a different album because that Adele album is one of my favorite albums of the period, the next one anyway.
I feel like it's a similar audience if it's not, it's not necessarily similar.
Yeah, I think so because I don't think this is, I don't know how, I mean, the millennials kind of, catch on to Rehab as a bit of a hashtag almost, you know, like it's...
The millennials are 40 years old at this stage, Adam.
Well, but I mean the millennial audience of this, you know, because this was obviously very popular at the time, you know, so...
This album is about... I guess, yeah. Is the album 10 years old or was her passing 10 years ago? There was a recent...
No, this is 2006, so it's 14 years old now, so...
So it's her passing is about 10 years. It was relevant. Yeah. Because I know there was an anniversary recently. Yeah, it's a really well-done album. And you can think there wouldn't be anything else that sounded like this at the time.
Not even close. So, like, and that's why she was so, and I guess.
Too bold from the blue.
I don't know. It's one of those things that I guess, you know, you always wonder. It's like you wonder what the next Nirvana album was going to sound like.
I was going to make that comparison too. Because isn't this like, I mean, you listen to the content of this. It's impossible to enjoy without the hindsight that this album was a cry for help, really. That not only was not heard, it was heard and then turned into fucking. Corporate coin.
Celebrate
the when the money was made off the back of her fucking pain, which is like it reminds you of Kurt Cobain singing that he swears that he doesn't have a gun in "Come As You Are." And it's like, oh, and in Euro, which is even more of a brutal fucking rip your guts open sort of album in terms of his sharing his pain on the page. But even Nirvana wasn't as bluntly autobiographical as this. You know, there wasn't.
No, it's really personal. It's really kind of. And just looking that this is the second highest selling album of the 2000s, behind Adele, of course. Yeah. Like, but.
And I wonder how much of that was post-mortem.
Well, I mean, the Adele album, the two Adele albums came 4 and 10 years after this, so it's kind of like it still took a while for people to kind of. Yeah, and I just sort of wonder maybe with this sound, she sounds like the kind of person though that wouldn't have stuck around on this sound for a little while. Like I don't know, even I read some stuff about Ronson who basically said this album was hard, but it was good because if anything he'd come up with, she went that shit, we're not doing it. And you're like, okay, like she was very very particular about how she wanted it to sound and what she wanted it to do and all that sort of stuff. So. I wouldn't have thought that if the record company came back to her, you know, if it continued and said, we want another album like that, she probably would have told them to jam it up their ass.
Well, the fact that she didn't come up with a second album before she passed, you know, that could have been artistic block as much as descending into the demons that she wrote about. I mean, I'm not going to be so grim as to say this album reads like a suicide note, but it certainly reads like a fucking... post-mortem toxicology report, doesn't it? You know, it's got a...
It's a hard...
Everything that she met her end from
was
outlined in these
songs. And it's an interesting juxtaposition. As I said, second highest selling album of the 2000s. This is a hard listen, this album. Like, this is not a comfortable album. I mean, I guess if you could let it float in the background and all that sort of stuff, you go... Yeah, it's kind of got that doo-woppy kind of feel. Yeah, but if you actually sit down to listen to it, it's hard work. Like, it really, and it's a
real. Well, the songs, I mean, we're not talking about the musical structures here. I mean, it's all sassy soul, funk, and jazz. But she literally opens up this kind of big Shirley Bassey style thing with, you know, what fuckery is this? And you think, this is an album that, you know, grandma should be listening to. And she's just this foul mouthed fucking pisshead who can't stop herself, you know, fucking and drugging and just causing wreckage all through the world. And sadly to her detriment, but it was it is kind of, you know, the comparison with Kurt Cobain is interesting because it is very much of that kind of better to burn out than rust out sort of lifespan.
Well, you would sort of almost wonder, and you don't want to sort of say, like, I mean, perhaps it's been said that there are certain artists, you know, who felt that they'd be more famous in death than what they would be alive. Yeah, you know, they're you know, rather than deliver that next album, they'd go out in a screaming heap.
It's not that this was a choice, but it's almost
the Jeff Buckley's of the world and all that sort of stuff. I you know, it's a hard thing to sort of say that. Can you view suicide as a publicity stunt? But
well, I wouldn't. You know, I wouldn't say that as much as I would say that. I would say that the personal traumas and psychological structures that gave forward to the behaviour that led to all this fantastic source material are exactly the same thing that would lead you to meet an early end through abusing all those things.
I mean, she was in a very, very dark place, obviously. Like this, and as you say, there's songs about heroin, there's songs about alcohol, there's songs about
incredibly honest songs about you know cleaning the house in the morning because you know it stops her from drinking. You think, oh, okay. That's where we are.
And very in and out too. Like, you know, there's some songs where she's got an idea, she puts it out there, verse, chorus, done, and the song just ends. And you think, oh, and then it's on to the next kind of thing. Like, there's no...
That's also kind of 60s pop structures too.
Yeah, that's obvious.
They really loved a two-minute pop song in those days. A
couple of times I kind of went, shit, that's the end. Like, because
it's a 34-minute album, isn't it? It's like really short.
Yeah, it's not. I did have a look at it before, but it's
in the 30s.
Because I seriously never listened to this album at all. But I've heard all the singles. Like, all as soon as they came around, I went, oh, yep, know that one, know that one, and it's just like, oh, okay. There's some interesting stuff. It does sound a lot like, 34, 46.
Yeah, but a bit like Nirvana. You know all the singles from Nirvana, but if you listen to Nevermind End to End or some of the later albums, the oppressiveness of the worldview kind of weighs on you more heavily than if you listen to any of those individual big singles, you know, Lithium or In Bloom or Smells Like Teen Spirit. If you listen to all of that plus all the darker stuff that was in between, then it has a bigger effect. And the same is true with this album. I mean, if you listen to Rehab, it just seems like a silly little song about, my friends say I should go to rehab, but my dad thinks I'm fine.
But that's the thing I think that I've gotten out of coming back and actually listening to this is I kind of felt I didn't have the back knowledge, I guess, of what was going on and all that sort of stuff and hadn't listened to it. And I kind of felt that Rehab was a little, it felt a little glib.
Yeah, like, it felt like a bit of a joke.
You know what I mean? It felt like almost the opposite reaction to, like, I kissed a girl and I liked it kind of thing. You know, it's not any great.
But it's something said to shock in the context of a pop song.
Yeah, absolutely. But then in the context of this album, the way it opens with that song, you kind of go, and then you listen to the rest of it, you go, wow, this is the least offensive thing that's on this album. Yeah.
You should go to rehab and your dad should go to rehab too because he's clearly enabling you. Unless she means by her daddy is, you know, her sugar daddy.
I think that's exactly what it means.
Well, I don't know. It's one of those deliberately ambiguous ones.
I actually kind of have a bit more, not respect, it's not the right word, but I kind of look at this album and go, that is a much better piece of construction I ever would have given it credit for off the back of the single. And I heard the other, like, but I heard Back to Black and, you know, and the unfortunate part of all this is, you know, and with the glut of television, you know, quote, talent shows that are around there is that a lot of these songs are becoming, you know, quote, singers songs. You know what I mean? Like if you've got a bit of a quirky voice and you go on a talent show and sing Amy Winehouse, everyone's like, oh my God, you know, neglecting, of course, the actual sort of
message.
Yeah, like it's just, you know, words don't matter as long as you can hit that note or, you know, you can get that sound and you can, you know. I kind of was a little bit worried. I thought maybe it's a little bit the same, like, because it is a very common theme right throughout. It doesn't let up at all.
Well, it explores different elements of her pathology, if you like.
Yeah. But it's really I can see why it grabbed all the attention at the time, because it really didn't grab me at the time. I heard Rehab and went, cool pop song, dude. Okay, I'm next. You know, it was like that. But and I guess because when the Adele stuff came along, it was probably a lot more in. It's a lot more of a comfortable listen.
Yes, it's a de-tattooed, been through rehab. Well, not even. Unlikely to ever go through rehab. It's sort of a two glasses of white wine and passing out on the couch kind of fucking
that's right,
snorting yeah, rails kind of, while getting railed from behind in a nightclub toilet kind of album, which is
it's hard and it's an interesting experiment that she obviously couldn't continue on. Like, it's just, but man, you know, I mean, they say art is hell and all that sort of stuff, but this was a special kind of it. But I'm glad I went back and had a listen to it because I think it's a really it's a worthwhile thing to kind of understand where that all happened. You know, because as you said, like, and the Nirvana is the perfect thing because there's such strong parallels to
that it was the
pain
and also that it was kind of the full fat, full richness, full spice version of this, and that it was then taken on by people who kind of sanded off the rough edges and polished it up and hid away some of the distortion and pain that grew it, and they produced a more palatable version that was more publicly popular.
And still yet you still got to say, you know, this is, you know, very personal and very, you know, because there's a lot of, you know, very personal stuff on the Adele thing, but it's, man, it's so, as you say, rounded off at the edges that...
Well, pain's not on the same level of self-destruction, so, yeah. But this, I mean, there's a lot of successful pop albums that are only considered great because they sold a lot of copies, and this isn't one of them. This is a classic album. It's really as a statement of the artist in time and space at the time of their career and where they were and what they wanted to say. You couldn't get a better example of what that is.
Yeah. And someone especially that was so careful about that sound, and you know, she obviously had that sound in her voice, but really it wasn't something the record company shoved her in and said, "Let's make a doo-wop album."
Let's make Shirley Bassey, or let's really make a fucking, let's make an album full of Bond themes. And that's the thing, it makes you wonder if Amy Winehouse got to grow old, what would she have been like? Would she have been like a Tina Turner? Mm. She have always ended up kind of lost in drink and drugs, but you know what?
Yeah, are people never get to find out. More interesting on the substances? Like, there's lots of artists, they sort of say,
can you only produce art this intense if you are running on a short wick?
Yeah, that's right. Like, and there's lots of evidence to say that may be the case.
27 Club.
I don't, yeah. It's a weird.
She's in the 27 Club, isn't she?
Yeah, I think she's
one of the 27. Yeah, because I was thinking Hendrix and so on and so forth. But I was like, shit, no, she's one of them. She's in there with Janis Joplin and whoever else.
Yeah, it's a hard listen. I was expecting a more saccharine sort of experience and got clubbed over the head by the lyrics, because I was sort of, and it's that's a deliberate thing, is that they sort of, it's such an innocuous repetitive sound that you kind of go searching in there to hear her voice, and then you listen to what she's saying and go, oh
yeah, but
Jesus.
I think that's actually it works, is because it's such an old-fashioned kind of oldies hits kind of sound, done really well. I mean, they're well done kind of 60s 70s club hits in the context of 60s and 70s club kind of sounds. But I mean,
it's not the kind of album I don't think I'd go back and go, oh, I'm just going to chill and listen to some music and put this on.
If she'd lived, if she'd lived, it would have just been, you know, a whole lot of funny songs about getting on the piss. It would be like listening to a Friends of Rom album, singing songs about drinking goon and you know, setting fire to your ass hairs. If she'd lived, this album would have been, you know, you'd feel very, very differently about it. You'd be able to enjoy it. And it's kind of tragic, is that the lifespan of this album as a classic album that you could enjoy was 2006 to 2010. Can't be done now.
Yeah. I think unless you're a fucking psychopath. I think it's still a good listen, though. Like, I think if it's something I would, you know, if I was on a long road trip or something like that and really wanted to sort of get into something and really listen to it, this would be close to something I would go and have a listen to, because I've got time to give it sort of space, but, you know, not to sort of have it in instruction. But,
and never mind, it's not as difficult to listen in 2020 as it was in, you know, 2000. So, you know, there'll probably be a time when this album doesn't feel like, why didn't we stop her?
Well, I don't think Nevermind either was as probably as, yeah, yes, it was probably introspective, but it was a bit more general.
It was still Bob Rock.
Nature.
Not Bob Rock. Butch Vig.
Yeah.
It was basically Bob Rock. But, you know, more the subsequent stuff was further down the spiral, to borrow the Nine Inch Nails album title. You know, Nevermind is the most palatable Nirvana album that would be prepared to listen to.
Got all the fun songs on it, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it was the big one. It was the pop album, as you like to refer to Metallica's Black Album.
Black.
1991 was such an interesting year for music, wasn't it? Just so much shit going on. We might get back to that point. But we're going to talk about an album from, unless you got anything else to say about the late.
No,
Sound
I think that, I think we've covered it like much different to what I expected it to. And especially even after two tracks, I kind of went, oh, is this going to be, you know? And then I went, okay. It changed my mind halfway through as I sort of listened to it more and more and more. And there's good songs all the way. The second last song is probably one of the best on the album, just because it just so
it
raw,
says yeah. It packs a lot into, you know, half an hour and change. It's it's a really well delivered thing. 1988 apparently wasn't all Poison and Guns N' Roses. It's the debut album of what I believe to be a bunch of music college kids called Living Colour.
Are we about to hit read from the about on Spotify?
No, it's not. I'm not going to read both. But
well, they didn't write it. So
Living Colour is spelled in the proper way with a U, because the guitarist, who's basically the driver behind the band, was born Britain. So he's like Vernon Reid, which Vernon's a very British.
And also, do you know who produced this album? Do you know who the executive producer on this album was?
So the producer of this album was Ed Stasium, and Mick Jagger helped on a few tracks, which is really weird.
Yeah, that's right.
But Ed Stasium also worked on a couple of Hoodoo Gurus albums around the same time. And there's, weirdly enough, there's some crossover in terms of the production choices of the same era. It's mostly the cleanliness of the guitar sound. Obviously, these guys played a lot more with... let's say kind of the Vi/Satriani end of guitar wankery of the period, in terms of harmonics, pedals, and fucking guitar synths and all that kind of good stuff.
Well, here's the thing, because I mean this really did come off the end of hair rock, didn't it? So like all that sort of.
Well, that's why I was putting in the context of Poison and Guns N' Roses, because that's what was the, I wouldn't say the state of the art, but the most popular stuff. There was that Van Halen, Joe Satriani, Steve Vai kind of guitar as the point of the exercise kind of
stuff. Well, this is what I sort of came to the conclusion that I sort of thought, and I thought, you know, that back in the 60s how they had all the amazing sort of black artists that had come along,
yes,
and you know, it's amazing, and then you'd have all the you know, the straight white guys come out and do these, you know, these white versions of all this sort of funk and R&B 60s music. This to me is like the reverse of that, except it's like they're looking at the whiteness of hair rock and hair hair metal and all that sort of stuff, because it's a very, very white bread, you know,
the whitest of all genres. I mean, metal is the whitest of all genres.
Yeah, and this is their take on that kind of, because I mean this was considered metal when it came out. Like,
well, yeah,
is,
but it was kind of funk metal, so it was kind of,
that's what I mean. And this is kind of got that sort of R&B, you know, African American kind of feel to the hair rock that was out, you know, coming at the time. This was their response to it, basically, and it just, you know, pushed it sort of forward, because it was, you know, like you said, it had this sort of funk vibe to it. Yet it's still heavy. Yet it's still got the riffs all through it.
Yeah, so, technically, I mean, they can play, and old mate can fucking wank with the best of them. He can furiously guitar masturbate as well as anything. And I think. The iconic track off this is, of course, Cult of Personality.
Cult of Personality.
That's Cult of Personality, folks. Which is their signature track and their opening track off this album. And it's still a certified fucking banger. It's just a ridiculous... And it just sounds so... I don't know how it sounds so enormous. Because production has moved on over the years, but nothing on earth sounds as large as the opening riff to Cult of Personality.
No, that's right. It's great.
Skyscraper.
And literally, and they're a four-piece. They were big sample users. Yeah. I had a friend of mine go and see them. They played Byron once. And
how
had
many years ago was
sample
that?
Sample pedals, 20 odd. You know, in their prime kind of thing. Like, they came along, they played the, you know, whatever, the back room of Byron or whatever it was when, you know, it was going on.
Great Northern.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, they played there, and they had sample pedals all over the stage, apparently, like they were triggering stuff and all that, and apparently it went very, very wrong in the middle of one song, and you know, people were throwing guitars at people and all sorts. But he said when it worked and when it all happened, because there's still all this, you know, that very, you know, the big vocal harmonies, you know, that very, there's a real R&B funk sensibility to this, but it's crunchy, it's got riffs, it's got And you know, it's like most of these kinds of riff-based albums. Some of them work, some of them don't quite work. You know, you can sort of see them trying.
Some of them land. I mean, Cult of Personality does feel like kind of Led Zeppelin, like early to mid-70s Led Zeppelin smashed into kind of R&B sensibility. But, I mean, you almost have to set aside, everyone knows Cult of Personality, and then they go into track two, and it's kind of just about there, but not really that interesting kind of I love you, baby, baby, I love you kind of song. And you think, fuck, what are we doing here? And then towards the end of that song, they break out of that structure and start playing around with it. And I feel like after that little hiccup, it was almost like they had to have like an I love you, baby, baby, I love you track just to make the record company happy. And then they kind of punched through that, and they got back into what they're good at, which is social commentary and political shit. I feel like they're not Public Enemy. Ironically, Public Enemy turn up as guests on one of these tracks, but they're not. I mean, Public Enemy were just coming up at the same kind of period, and they're not political animals like that. They're not from the streets like that either. I believe, I haven't been able to fact check this, but I'd read somewhere that they were all, middle class music college scholarship kids. So that's why they're all brilliant musicians. But they were kind of, they'd been playing in music classes and conservatoriums and shit for conservatories for years. Okay. So that's why they were all so brilliant. But they were not, they weren't like, straight out of Compton, crazy motherfucker called Ice Cube kind of thing. Which is also around the same time as well. Which is a point we might come back to, but it's kind of interesting how brief a period Living Colour got to be the state of the art. They had this album, and they had the album after it, which it's a good album too. I didn't pick that one because
it's the one with Love Rears. Yes. That's the one that sort of everyone will know. And it's interesting that the album version of that is what you don't hear much. Like it's the very, it's got that sort of backbeat, hip hop kind of DJ feel to it, whereas the one that most people know is...
Well, there's two versions.
Yeah.
There's two versions. There was the one that got played on... There was the one that got played in the charts, which is the single version, which is the kind of the straight R&B with riffs.
Blues kind of.
Blues song, basically. And then there's the Soul Power remix, which is also bloody brilliant. I mean, both versions of that song are absolutely brilliant, but that was the version that got played on things like Triple J.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always pushed because I've played this song 1,000 times with covered band, and you kind of like the space and the other one's just so brutal.
Soul Power version just sort of skips along, which is quite a joy. That's Time's Up. It's the second album. So they had the second album in 1990, and then, as we were talking about before, all of music got turned on its head in 1991. I mean, that's the sort of thing old people say, but it kind of is true. I mean, when you had, Metallica going mainstream, and you had big grunge albums dropping, and you had the Chili Peppers album dropping, and you had a whole lot of other complete sort of sea changes in sound, and a whole genre of rock music just ended. I mean, that kind of hair metal just dead stopped. And then after that, it was all grunge and post-grunge and eventually new metal. And quite a while after that, the new rock revolution, which kind of looked back to the 60s and 70s, but it never went back to the hair metal of the 80s. So Living Colour kind of became a super evolved version of a sound that immediately ended.
Yes, that's right. And they've got quite a lot of back catalogue. Like it's quite a lot of stuff.
They kept going.
Yeah.
I'm sure people have been listening to it, but I mean, the thing is that they weren't just doing hair metal. I mean, there was like funk and jazz and R&B and that new jack swing that was very big at the time, that kind of cross hybrid of hip hop and R&B. And they played with that sort of stuff a lot more on the second album. The second album I actually own a copy of, I think, which is why I didn't pick it for this exercise. So I bought an old secondhand copy because I wanted to get Love Rears Its Ugly Head for a 90s compilation I was making.
See, and the other song, and then the other big song that people probably know him for is on the next album, Stain, which is Bye.
Yes.
It's probably the next, Everybody Wants You When You're Bye.
But that gets into sort of, that was more kind of R&B New Jack Swing as well. That kind of, got more and more.
You're probably getting around the time then at all the sort of the big R&B, like the Boys to Men's and all that sort of stuff.
Well, yeah, 92, 93 kind of area. Your Bobby Brown has been big and done all the drugs and then all the other drugs. But yeah, it's interesting. But
he did all the drugs with Amy Winehouse.
It is bizarre that there was, for a debut album, there were so many huge guests on here. You had Public Enemy guesting on a track. You had Mick Jagger producing two tracks and fucking doing backing vocals on one.
And they toured. Well, they toured with, because they toured this album as the openers for the Rolling Stones. Yeah, apparently, but, I read on there.
So that must have been where the connection linked in.
Yeah, well, I think it says on their thing that they basically got popular by playing CBGBs.
Yep.
And in New York, and so that's where they got their crowd. That's where they got their,
which was a legendary punk venue of the '70s. Although it was a bit less genre defined by the '80s.
But you can kind of see how this. It just really feels like this is kind of like the funk response to hair metal.
Yeah, this is the black people who invited themselves to the white person's picnic. And said, like, no, this is our version.
Yeah, but did it better because they kind of had a bit of room about it. It's got a groove. You know, people, you know, the whitest people in the room will still nod their head to Love Rears or they'll listen to that riff in Cult of Personality, which is
because it's informed by funk and because it's informed by soul. And it's just like Hendrix compared to his the guys who are around him at the same time in the same scene, you know, even Clapton and Jimmy Page and guys like that.
It's the Hendrix version of All Along the Watchtower as opposed to the Dylan version of All Along the Watchtower. Yeah, he might not have written it.
It's the Hendrix version of Sunshine of My Love compared to the Cream original. If you heard the Hendrix version, ironically, there's actually a cover of Living Colour have done a cover of A Sunshine of My Love, which was on one of their 90s albums. And it's much more in the Hendrix style. It's fucking blistering. And Sunshine of My Love is a Sunshine of Your Love, sorry. Sunshine of Somebody's Love is a brilliant song. I mean, it's just a fucking blues progression, but it's still a brilliant song. But Hendrix's version had amazing life to it that just wasn't there even in the brilliant original Cream version.
Yeah, but it wasn't a bad listen. It's not something I probably, like, there's a lot of filler on there. There's a couple of good songs
There's some stuff that doesn't work, yeah. I actually think Time's Up might be a better album in terms of a coherent, delivered concept.
Mm.
And I had it in my head that they were gone a bit experimental and some of the stuff didn't really work on Time's Up. And that's true, but they still land, even if as they're wandering off into territory that doesn't quite make sense, they're still landing a lot of the punches they're throwing. So, but really, their first two albums, before the ass dropped out of hair metal, were exceptionally good. So they should definitely be, they should definitely be reconsidered. And they could play too. It wasn't like they were just.
And it was immense.
They were just studio guys.
It was. I was going to say it was an immensely fun song to play in Guitar Hero, because it was in the best version of Guitar Hero. Cult of Personalities was one of the songs, and you got to that solo and went, Jesus.
If you listen back to that solo, you listen carefully, you're like, the 1990s were the era of the guitar wanking god. You know, that there was entire albums just of guitar wanking gods that were massively popular, and that's up there with the tapping solos and all the
rest. Oh, he was a shredder.
Shredmaster general. And presumably still is. Yeah, no. I mean, they're all still alive. Which
No, he's still releasing music. I just clicked on his thing on Spotify, and he's still got music.
They're still going, yeah. I mean, which is nice because, you know, they're singing about the crackhead epidemics in major cities. Because the 80s were grim as shit, you know, for that sort of stuff. So they all got through. But, yeah, do yourself a favour, etc.
Good fun. Good fun.
In fact, I forgot to do a boys playlist song for Bezo last week, so I will suggest.
Actually,
you know what? I'm going to suggest "Love Rears Its Ugly Head," but it's up to him as to whether he wants the Soul Power remix or the original, because they're both equally good.
It's got needs to be more space in music, I reckon.
Yeah. Well, the problem is, I had a look, and on Spotify they only have like the 6.5 minute version of the Soul Power remix, not the nice. Well, it's not that it's a problem, but there's a 7-inch mix, which is the one that you're familiar with. That just gets to the. There's a lot less kind of fucking about with extended drum loops, which feels a bit kind of primal screamy. But yeah, this will actually tell whether Bezo listens to this episode, whether one of the versions of Love Rears Its Ugly Head turns up on the boys' playlist.
He listens to see how much if we pay him out at all.
I think we just have his mere existence. It's enough to do that.
But no, that was interesting. I think I kind of it was when we sort of said, you know, you picked your album, it's like go out and pick yours. I went, ooh. okay. So I kind of went back and had a look through some, you know, these are the albums you should have listened to kind of lists. And you know, there's a couple there I went, nah, I don't, you know, I just...
I can live without that in my life, yeah.
Yeah, there was a reason why I didn't go and listen to those albums, you know. But when I saw the Amy Winehouse one come up, I went, yeah, now that's actually not a bad point. Because I kind of, well, you know, you always know that she was, you know, she could sing, like she was... But I really hadn't dug in any, you know, I hadn't even scratched the surface of what was sort of behind that album and all that.
And now you wish you had, because it's grim.
Well, yeah, it was so hard
that's work, a lot of pain and quite a lot of substance abuse. Oh, well. You'll be glad to know, folks, that nowhere near as much substance abuse when we were making this episode of Tripping Balls. This was Tripping Balls. Adam H. Photo has joined us this week. Thank you very much to him.
Pleasure.
We'll be back next week. And until then, catch you later.